from that conflict. So I make no apology for that. I think again, recognizing we are there to defend democracy, and the fact is, eventually we will see some benefit in business over time. Everything that's being shipped into Ukraine today, of course, is coming out of stockpiles, either at DOD, the Department of Defense, or from our NATO allies, and that's all great news. Eventually, we will have to replenish it, and we will see a benefit to the business over the next coming years, unquote. The Russia-Ukraine crisis will indeed be a bonanza for the likes of Raytheon and Lockheed Martin. First of all, there will be the contracts to resupply weapons like Raytheon's Stinger anti-aircraft missile and the Raytheon Lockheed Martin-produced Javelin anti-tank missile that Washington has already provided to Ukraine by the thousands. The bigger stream of profits, however, will come from assured post-conflict increases in national security spending in Europe and in the US, justified, at least in part, by the disasters that followed. Indeed, direct arms transfers to Ukraine already reflect only part of the extra money going to US military contractors. This fiscal year alone, they are guaranteed to also reap significant benefits from the Pentagon's Ukraine Security Assistance Initiative, that is USAI, and the State Department's Foreign Military Financing, that is FMF program, both of which finance the acquisition of American weaponry and other equipment, as well as military training. Since then, the United States regime has committed around $5 billion in security assistance to that country. According to the U.S. State Department, the United States has provided such military aid to, as they claim, help Ukraine preserve its territorial integrity, secure its borders, and improve interoperability with NATO. So, when Russian troops began to mass on the Ukrainian border last year, Washington quickly upped the ante. On March 31, 2021, the U.S. European Command declared a potential imminent crisis, given the estimated 100,000 Russian troops already along that border and within Crimea. As last year ended, the Biden administration had committed $650 million in weaponry to Ukraine, including anti-aircraft and anti-armor equipment like the Raytheon Lockheed Martin Javelin anti-tank missile. Since then, according to Pentagon reports, the United States regime has committed to giving approximately $2.6 billion in military aid to that country, bringing the Biden administration total to more than $3.2 billion and is still rising. Some of this assistance was included in a March emergency spending package for Ukraine, which required the direct procurement of weapons from defense industry, including drones, laser-guided rocket systems, machine guns, ammunition, and other supplies. The major military industrial corporations will now seek Pentagon contracts to deliver that extra weaponry, even as they are gearing up to replenish Pentagon stocks already delivered to the Ukrainians. On that front, in fact, military contractors have much to look forward to. More than half of the Pentagon's $6.5 billion portion of the emergency spending package for Ukraine is designated simply to replenish Department of Defense inventories. In all, lawmakers allocated $3.5 billion to that effort, $1.75 billion more than the president even requested. They also boosted funding by $150 million for the U.S. State Department's FMF program for Ukraine. And keep in mind that those figures don't even include emergency financing for the Pentagon's acquisition and maintenance costs, which are guaranteed to provide more revenue streams for the major weapons makers. Better yet, from the viewpoint of such companies, there are many bites left to take from the apple of Ukrainian military aid. Another positive side effect of the war for Lockheed, Raytheon, and other arms merchants like them is the push by House Armed Services Committee Chair Adam Smith and Ranking Committee Republican Mike Rogers of Alabama to speed up production of a next-generation anti-aircraft missile to replace the Stinger. In his congressional confirmation hearing, William LaPlante, the latest nominee to head acquisition at the Pentagon, argued that America also needs more hot production lines for bombs, missiles, and drones. Consider that yet another benefit in waiting for the major weapons contractors.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Just days ago, Israeli occupation forces attacked Al-Quds' Al-Aqsa Mosque, wounding more than 150 Palestinians while it was filled with Ramadan worshippers on one of the holiest days in the Islamic calendar. Now, in a fresh bout of violence, Israeli forces have again targeted Palestinian worshippers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Dozens of Israeli military forces have stormed into the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in the occupied old city of Al-Quds and restricted the entry of Palestinian worshippers into the Flashpoint holy site to secure the incursion of hundreds of extremist settlers to mark the Passover holiday. This is while the day before, the settlers entered the compound amid a heavy military deployment of Israeli soldiers to mark the Passover holiday and perform their own prayers. This year, the Jewish religious occasion coincides with the Muslim fasting month of Ramadan at a time when thousands of Muslims, predominantly Palestinians, usually stay at the holy site for worship, a rare convergence that will drive unusually high numbers of Jewish, Muslim, and Christian worshippers to the old city of Al-Quds. Far-right Jewish groups have even called for raids of the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound during the Jewish Passover holiday and the offering of animal sacrifices in its courtyards, which has not occurred since ancient times. Sacred to Muslims and revered by Jews, the Al-Aqsa Mosque, Islam's third holiest site, has long been a flashpoint in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
And it's really pushing the Palestinians out of Jerusalem. It's trying to Judaize the city of Jerusalem. And we saw them attacking completely innocent people, you know, old people, women, children. So it's not really about security for Jewish worshippers.
Al Palestinians in the occupied territories have reacted to the raids by the Israeli security forces by going out to the streets in support of the worshippers. Israel, meanwhile, is trying to paint a different narrative. The Western-backed media is hard at work painting the Palestinians as the aggressors, even calling the worshippers rioters and terrorists. Israel says its so-called security operation is an effort to protect freedom of worship from violent rioters desecrating the site and endangering the public, but it has a tough task since scores of videos show the opposite to be the case. Palestinians are angry on a wide variety of fronts. They are suffering immensely due to the Israeli occupation. Additionally, they are amazed at the international community's indifference to Palestinian suffering amid the Ukraine crisis. Furthermore, the paralysis of the Palestinian leadership has added salt to their wounds, who seems unable to do anything. The resistance group Hamas, however, has described the crisis as the continuing terrorism of the occupation and its crimes, attempts to Judaize Al-Quds and to perform sacrifices in the Al-Aqsa Mosque to build its so-called temple during what they call Passover. The Gaza Strip, meanwhile, is at risk of another Israeli onslaught. Israeli tanks and armored vehicles have made an incursion into northern Gaza Strip, raising the possibility of another war.
Governments around the world need to stop supporting the Israeli aggressions against the Palestinians. And I can say myself, as a rabbi and as a Jewish person, the Jewish communities around the world have to stop supporting the Israeli aggression against the Palestinians.
A similar Israeli assault on Al-Aqsa during Ramadan last year sparked a military confrontation between resistance factions in Gaza, led by Hamas and Israel. Hamas has said this year Israel's assault on the Al-Aqsa and its worshippers is a declaration of war. And sure enough, early on Tuesday, the Gaza Strip came under Israeli assault, reportedly after rocket fire from the Gaza Strip. This is a sure sign that another war may be in the making.
Scuffles and unrest were reported in several spots across Sweden. Fierce clashes have broken out between police and protesters during demonstrations against a far-right group's intention to burn the Holy Quran. Violent skirmishes erupted between supporters of the Strom Curse party and the opponents of the blasphemous plan. Clashes and demonstrations have been held in a couple of cities. Over a dozen police officers have also been injured since the unrest started. Meanwhile, police has backed the hardline party's plan, saying it would not revoke permission for a demonstration organized by the party, because this free speech threshold for doing that is very high in Sweden. That's why there have been reported clashes in locations that the hardline party either had planned or had demonstrations. Also, Swedish Prime Minister Magdalena Andersson came out in support of the far-right group, making remarks that have been deemed provocative. She said in Sweden people are allowed to express their opinions whether they are in good or bad taste. That is part of our democracy. These remarks only fanned the fire of unrest across the country and drew condemnations from the Muslim world, like from Iran. Iran summoned the Swedish envoy and condemned the desecration of the Holy Quran, saying the blasphemy was committed under the protection of the Swedish police. Tehran said it would hold the Swedish government as accountable and expects an immediate reaction from Stockholm against the perpetrator, as well as practical measures to prevent such incidents. On Thursday, the hardline party held a rally in a heavily Muslim-populated area in Sweden. At the demonstration, the party leader burned a copy of the Holy Quran, ignoring objections from onlookers. Counter-protests broke out with demonstrators setting fire to security vehicles after police ignored calls to stop the far-right demonstration. Strom Curse is well known for its anti-immigrant and anti-Islam stances. Anti-Muslim sentiments have been on the rise across Europe in recent years in the wake of terrorist attacks in the continent, carried out mostly by Daesh sympathizers or the terrorist group's members who returned home following the group's defeat in Iraq and Syria. Muslim leaders in Europe and around the world have repeatedly condemned the terrorist attacks,
Moreover, the rise of far-right ideology and the propagation of anti-immigration policies have also exacerbated the status of religious minorities in Europe. Also, different sorts of bans on hijab in countries like Germany and France, as well as closure of mosques and religious centers, have further pressured the Muslim community in those countries. Add to it the discrimination in recruitment and provision of job opportunities, harassment at workplace, and hate speech. Also, hate crimes against Muslims are rife in Europe. While the Muslim communities represent an indispensable minority of more than 25 million people, in the 27 European Union member states, a 2018 poll found that within the bloc, an average 37% of the population admits to having unfavorable views of Muslims. The mainstream Western media usually give coverage to Muslim matters through the prism of negative and counterproductive stereotypes. This biased coverage further promotes unreal stereotypes. In addition, European leaders have either been unsuccessful or reluctant in providing a convincing counter-narrative to Islamophobia. The UK has announced a controversial deal with Rwanda to send illegal immigrants and asylum seekers to the East African country. The British government claims the scheme, which is worth $156 million, would stop smugglers from sending thousands of desperate migrants on dangerous journeys across the English Channel every year. Over 28,000 migrants and refugees have crossed the English Channel in 2021. That's three times higher than the year before. In November last year, 27 people died while trying to reach the UK when their boat sank in the worst disaster to occur on the Channel. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson hailed the deal with Kigali, saying the East African country with a sketchy human rights record is one of the safest countries in the world, globally recognized for its record of welcoming and integrating migrants. Rwanda already hosts some 140,000 refugees in six refugee camps. However, rights groups and refugee organizations swiftly slammed what they called a cruel, inhumane, and neo-colonial plan. They also questioned both its costs to British taxpayers and its effect on migration. According to a recent poll, 60% of the British public is dissatisfied with the Johnson government's migration policy. The UN's refugee agency has also voiced opposition, saying people fleeing persecution should not be treated like commodities. The world body stated that such arrangements simply shift asylum responsibilities, evade international obligations, and are contrary to the letter and spirit of the Refugee Convention. Others have criticized Rwanda's human rights record, accusing the government of torturing, intimidating, and assassinating their political opponents, and persecuting marginalized people. Johnson said the deal will become a new international standard in handling migration, but human rights groups have warned that the plan could set a dangerous trend for other Western countries to adopt their offshore asylum schemes.
Well, Britain has a good history of trading in human beings. As you know, the whole sort of movement of Africans to North America, Britain was a leading player in shipping slaves from Africa to North America and to Caribbean islands. So Britain has a track record of trading in human beings. So one could, if you like, describe it in that manner. But I think the evil aspect of what's really happening in 2022, that may have happened 200 years ago, and when later on slavery was banned. But the reality is that perhaps we are living in a new epoch of slavery at this time.
British Prime Minister Boris Johnson has vowed to curb the English Channel crossings. However, there has been a drastic increase in the number of people arriving on British shores on small boats in recent years. The government passed a Nationality and Borders Bill that would make it a criminal offence to enter the UK illegally, and it would introduce life sentences for people smugglers. But The UN's refugee agency criticized the bill, saying it would penalize most refugees seeking asylum in the country and would create an asylum model that undermines established international refugee protection rules and practices. Meanwhile, the refugee deal with Rwanda comes as more Ukrainians arrive in the UK through different visa programs that the Johnson government has rolled out in the wake of the Russia-Ukraine war. Over 55,000 visas have been issued to refugees fleeing the conflict in Ukraine so far. This clearly shows a contradiction between the proposed policy and the British government's attitude toward Ukrainian refugees.
Reality is that the British government is acting in a very racist manner as well. They might say that, okay, it was sort of media correspondence who depicted the European the Ukrainian refugees in that manner. But the reality is that the implementation of this policy perhaps smacks of what I call racism, clear and without any sort of dilution to it.
Unlike what the British government claims, those seeking to cross the English Channel and land on British soil are not illegal economic migrants, but are mainly those who have escaped bloodshed, war and terror. They are people fleeing oppression and violence from Afghanistan, West Asia or even Europe. They are exercising their right under the UN Refugee Convention, which the UK was a founding signatory of, to seek asylum in a country of their choosing. And let's not forget that they are no different from Ukrainian refugees.
Israeli forces have stormed the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in the occupied old city of Al-Quds and attacked the Palestinian worshippers there. The raid began at dawn on Friday when Israeli forces entered the compound through the Moroccan Gate, also known as the Mughrabi Gate, throwing stun grenades and shooting rubber bullets at the crowd indiscriminately. 400 Palestinians were arrested. Media reports said the Israeli forces also attacked paramedics and press crews, chased them in the courtyards of Al-Aqsa Mosque, and beat a number of them. The Palestinian Red Crescent Society reported that 152 fasting Palestinians had been transferred to hospitals in the occupied Al-Quds for injuries as a result of the raid. Following the Friday prayers, people held rallies in the Gaza Strip in solidarity with the Palestinians at the Al-Aqsa Mosque.
They want it for themselves. They want the Palestinians gone. They want Islam to be gone from Palestine and Christianity too, everything except Judaism. So really, they don't mind having this as a flashpoint for them, as a center of dispute. They want this dispute to go on until they win. That's what they're looking for. And every time they bring settlers there to cause trouble, it's part of what they see as a continuing war for their control of the land. That's what this is about.
The regime has stepped up its deadly acts of aggression across the Palestinian territories since the beginning of Ramadan, as a result of which Palestinians put up a stronger resistance to counter the aggression. The events unfolding in the occupied territories are reminiscent of clashes between the Israeli forces and Palestinians in the West Bank last year that led to an 11-day war between the resistance groups in Gaza and Israel. Over 250 Palestinians were killed in the war, many of them were women and children. Observers now believe that more confrontations are imminent. As the pressure mounts, Palestinians have stepped up their retaliatory operations against the Israelis. Over the past 3 weeks, Palestinians have carried out 4 such retaliatory operations, killing over a dozen Israelis. Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett has given the regime's forces a free hand to crack down on Palestinians. He has also called on Israeli civilians with gun licenses to carry weapons in public.
they can find ways to make the Israeli occupation painful. And already, actually, quite a few Israelis over the last decade have emigrated elsewhere. You have Israeli immigration into Europe and the United States and to Australia. Possibly as many as a million Israelis have done that. If the Palestinians can make it painful enough for the Israelis might just disappear.
When some Arab states announce the normalization of ties with Israel, they claim that their moves will help the Palestinian cause. But the events of the past couple of years have shown that the only contribution their newly established ties with Tel Aviv made to Palestinians has been even more suffering. In the absence of any accountability, Israel is expected to put even more pressure on the people of Palestine. But the Palestinians are indicating that they remain steadfast to keep fighting against the Israeli occupation with or without international support.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of the speech delivered on April 12, 2022 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the government officials of the Islamic Republic. All praise is due to God, the Lord of the worlds. And peace and greetings be upon our Master Muhammad and upon his pure progeny. And may God curse all their enemies. I'm very thankful to God, the Exalted, for bestowing on me the opportunity to meet with you, government officials and executives, even in a limited way. And this blessed month, by God's favor, I hope that we will be able to receive divine blessings and kindness. Thanks to your purity and sincerity. I'm very grateful to Mr. President as well. He delivered a good report, and I hope that he will be able to move the affairs forward with a good pace and in the right time. What I want to discuss with you, dear ones, are a few spiritual words of advice on the occasion of the month of Ramadan. In fact, these words of advice are primarily addressed to this humble person himself. I must discuss them so that my heart is hopefully influenced by them, because I myself need these pieces of advice more than all of you.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
another part of my speech is related to your work, your spirit, and your sentiments as you are officials in different areas of the country. Another part of my statements is related to operational tasks in certain areas on the basis of experience and our outlook towards different matters. As for my words of advice, primarily I wish to say that one of my requests, which is also reflected in prayers narrated by the Imam, is to make our intentions pure. In a Ramadan prayer, there is a statement which says, strength, freshness, repentance, forgiveness, and a pure intention. Having a pure intention is very important. We should sincerely make an agreement with ourselves and our God to move forward on the correct path, the path that we believe in a determined way, and without feeling tired. This is what a pure intention is. By God's favor, if you make your intentions pure and strengthen this in yourselves, this will help you continue the path during your term of responsibility. This pure intention will help you move forward.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
In the limelight.
The Zionist regime's repression of human rights workers will only escalate as the investigation progresses and with no pushback from the regime's allies, who seem happy to uphold international law when it suits them. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Maureen Claire Murphy, journalist. This article is published under the heading International Silence Fuels Israeli Regime Persecution. Stay tuned for more. The Zionist regime's recent designation of several prominent Palestinian groups as terrorist organizations should be easy for liberal democracies to condemn. The designations were handed out based on secret evidence and came without any due process. The organizations in question are highly respected locally and well integrated into the international human rights scene. But the EU, US, Canada, and UK have yet to explicitly reject the Zionist regime's shabby attempt. In the words of Zayd Raad al-Hussein, the former UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, to sully the reputations of Palestinian human rights defenders. None of these governments appear convinced by the Zionist regime's accusations, but they have not even given their ally a deadline to present credible evidence justifying the designations aimed at starving those groups of international funding. And in its attempt to isolate and marginalize these groups, some of which provide key services to Palestine's most vulnerable communities, the Zionist regime is profoundly upending the lives of the human rights and social service providers in his crossers. One of those human rights defenders is Khatam Safin, the president of the Union of Palestinian Women's Committees. In February, Safin was sentenced to 16-month imprisonment by an Israeli regime military court. She was already in Israeli regime detention and had been since November 2020. Half of that time was spent in administrative detention without charge or trial. When the Zionist regime finally did level charges against Safin, they alleged that she was helping to oversee the transfer of funds from the now outlawed Palestinian groups, including the Union of Palestinian Women's Committees, to the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. As is typical of its cases against Palestinians dragged through its military court system, the Zionist regime's case against Safin relied on secret evidence to which neither she nor her lawyer were privy. Like many Palestinians denied due process in the Zionist regime's military court system, Safin agreed to a plea deal that dropped the money laundering charges. She was convicted of membership in the PFLP and to being president of the now Union of Palestinian Women's Committees. The Palestinian human rights group Al-Wamir observes that the Zionist regime initially leveled a long set of inflated charges against Safin, well beyond any singular specific act she allegedly carried out. This is another time-worn Israeli regime tactic. Inflating the number of charges is a practice widely used by the Zionist regime military prosecution to extend detention and trial procedures as a punitive and coercive measure against the detainee, Al-Wamir adds. In other words, the Zionist regime throws a spaghetti pot of charges at the wall and very little sticks. But deprived of anything resembling a fair trial, Palestinian detainees agree to plead guilty to lesser offenses they did not commit to curtail their ordeal and time away from their families. The Zionist regime also pressures Palestinians to accept idea plea deals in order to avoid having to prove their case against them in court. When Palestinians don't accept the plea deals, the process drags on. Muhammad Al-Halabi, a charity worker living in Gaza, is a case in point. On seemingly unending trial, Al-Halabi has been detained for more than a half a decade, and his case has gone to court some 170 times. Al-Halabi has turned down numerous plea deals, refusing to admit guilt for a crime he insists he did not commit. That is the hellish ordeal that Safin 60 was facing, and it was what Jonah Reshmavi 63 was up against when she took a similar plea deal that saw her sentenced to 13 months in prison for her work with the Palestinian Health Work Committees, a group declared illegal by the Zionist regime nearly 2020. The Health Work Committees was not informed of the designation until the Zionist regime began an escalated campaign against the organization, arresting its director, Shatta Odeh, and closing its headquarters in Ramallah, the seat of the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank. Odeh 60 has been in Israeli regime detention since occupation troops stormed her home in July last year. The charges against Odeh primarily revolve around her leadership role in the Health Work Committees, according to Al-Wamir. Odeh is also the chair of the Palestinian NGO Network, a coalition of dozens of Palestinian civil society groups. Al-Wamir argues that the arrest of Odeh indicates the Zionist regime's increasing brazenness in clamping down and criminalizing Palestinian human rights defenders and civil society organizations that challenge the Zionist regime's settler colonialism, and apartheid. Ultimately, the terror designations and the Zionist regime's long-standing campaign against Palestinian human rights defenders is aimed at preserving its impunity. The Zionist regime's moves against these individuals and groups is also a sign of desperation that it is losing its grip on the narrative, with a growing consensus among international human rights groups that the Zionist regime is practicing apartheid against Palestinians. Shawan Jabarin, the director of Al-Haq, one of the targeted organizations, told a panel recently convened by the Carter Center, "We removed the mask from their faces. Global human rights consensus now holds that the Zionist regime is a colonial regime. This is an oppressive regime. We crossed the red lines when we came to the issue of accountability and going after the Israeli criminals," he added. During that same event, Wissam Ahmad, also with Al-Haq, noted that the terror designations and other moves against the Palestinian groups are being issued by the same Israeli regime officials being investigated by the International Criminal Court. The movement at the level of the International Criminal Court is something that the Palestinian civil society organizations such as Al-Haq have been heavily involved in pushing forward, and despite the Zionist regime's attempts to stifle the progress towards this investigation, it has continued to move forward. Ahmad said it comes as no surprise that the Israeli regime would take such action during the process of investigation at the ICC. It's very much a reflection of the apartheid tactics to persecute those organizations and individuals that are seeking to challenge that regime. Meanwhile, the Zionist regime's repression of human rights workers will only escalate as the investigation progresses, and with no pushback from Israeli allies, who seem happy to uphold international law when it suits them.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahan Abbott, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
The French presidential election is being described as a populist bloc of Marine Le Pen versus an elitist bloc of Emmanuel Macron, but many don't seem to want to join either group. The first round's third-place finisher held an internal poll. Almost 70% of his leftist supporters will either abstain or submit blank ballots rather than vote for either candidate. France's Muslims don't see a choice which isn't Islamophobic. Macron continues to support bashing Islamo-leftism, while Le Pen has an on-again, off-again plan to give fines for wearing the hijab in public. The student class isn't taking sides either. They recently blocked universities over what they say are two bad candidates.
The elder class may provide the key vote. Back when he expected an easy victory, Macron promised to raise the retirement age to 65. Now he's backtracking in an effort to win over left-wing voters, but many aren't sure what his true plans really are.
Le bilan d'Emmanuel Macron n'est pas forcément positif.
Macron's record isn't very positive. Long-term unemployment, economic instability, the destabilizing effects of the yellow vests. People have many different reasons for being disappointed with him.
In 2017, the two mainstream parties were swept out of power, but the repeat second-round matchup has many voters upset that new ideas remain absent.
La ligne conservatrice, réactionnaire.
The conservative and reactionary line is championed by Le Pen, but she's very divisive. Many of her electorate preferred Eric Zemmour in the first round, and then there are many mainstream conservatives who will never vote for her or the National Rally. The key traits of this vote are bitter abstention and bored indecisiveness.
Most polls show Macron leading by around 6 to 8 points, but that's within the margin of error, and Western polls have consistently undercounted the right nationalist candidate. The runoff is on April 24th. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
There are many security experts who claim the expansion of NATO in recent years close to Russia's borders and provocative military exercises are factors that brought about the conflict in Ukraine. Now EU members Finland and Sweden are poised to announce they want to join NATO. One analyst has been giving us his reaction via broadband.
That's a very serious escalation toward Russia, because this is when the United States will put nuclear bombs in Finland, and that would mean a direct escalation that Russia will not accept.
Finland shares a border with Russia that is more than 1,300 kilometres long. Moscow points out that if this country was to join the 30-nation alliance, NATO's land border with the Russian Federation would more than double in length. A new opinion poll by Le Soir newspaper has found that 90% of citizens surveyed in Belgium said the war worries them, but that they do not support direct military intervention over concerns that it could trigger a new world war. A quarter of those questioned said the West's supply of weapons to fighters in Ukraine is, quote, a bad thing. We have also been asking members of the public about this.
Yeah, I think we should stop doing that, huh? Because war... fights war and then ends up in more war. So it's more about like discussing, talking.
It's a very good thing to have a dialogue with Russians and hopefully sort this out without war.
Ideally, diplomacy is the way that this comes to an end, but it takes two sides. From what I'm reading, they don't want to negotiate at all yet.
On Tuesday, the European Commission defended the decisions taken by EU governments to send arms to Ukraine.
In this case, more weapons doesn't mean more war. More weapons for Ukraine means more ability for the Ukrainian army to defend its people.
As concerns over possible escalation continue to increase, Finland and Sweden are expected to announce, before the end of this month, if they intend to join NATO. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
People in the west of Afghan capital Kabul were once again terrified after three explosions hit an educational center and a high school, leaving dozens of people dead and injured. Soon after the attack, we rushed Abdulrahim Shahid High School to talk with eyewitnesses.
After the first explosion, I arrived at the scene. Then suddenly the next blast hit the school alley. I saw dozens of students fall on the ground. People started to take the dead and wounded to hospital.
The targeted school is located in Hazaraz residential area, where the community has been bearing the brunt of Balyan terror attacks. People are now calling on the Taliban to tighten the security and protect all Afghans.
I call on the Taliban to tighten security across our country and protect those at risk. My sister and her children are living here. They are horrified. I don't want this situation to continue. Besides, we can't dare to send our children to educational centers. When will poor Hazaras live in peace? They have long been falling victim to terrorism.
The Taliban, on the other hand, claim that they won't let such attacks repeat in the future, vowing to bring the orchestrators to justice.
First of all, we extend our sympathy to the families of the victims. Secondly, our intelligence and security forces are investigating the incident and will hold those who martyred our innocent citizens accountable. I promise our Hazara brothers that we will take urgent steps to protect them against our common enemy. We will also pay major attention to the security of their public places.
Last year, at least 58 people were killed and more than 100 injured in a bomb attack in a girls' school in the same Shia neighborhood in Kabul. In recent years, suicide attacks in western Kabul have taken the lives of hundreds of civilians, including students. People here say they're exhausted by growing violence and terrorism. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
In a Twitter post, the head of Yemen's national negotiating delegation, Mohammed Abdussalam, said since the entry of the UN brokered truce, the Saudi-led coalition has prevented flights from reaching the Sana'a International Airport and obstructed the entry of fuel ships to the port of Hodeidah.
We have entered the third week of the truce while Sana'a Airport has not been opened yet, as it was supposed. Unfortunately, no commercial flight has arrived, even though the airport is technically ready. We do not know what are the reasons that prevent the opening of the airport until now, but what we do know is that the Saudi-led coalition has not adhered to any agreements since the start of its war on our country in 2015.
Observers say the Saudi violations are threatening the UN brokered agreement which is supposed to build for a comprehensive political solution. They are calling on the United Nations to intervene and open Sana'a Airport. In the beginning of April, the UN envoy for Yemen, Hans Grundberg, announced a two-month truce. The agreement includes opening Sana'a Airport for two flights per week and allowing Yemen's fuel ships to arrive at Hodeidah Port. For 7 years of war and siege, the United Nations has always been providing the political cover-up for Saudi Arabia's violations of international law. But now that it has brokered an agreement, it should take real measures to force Riyadh to do its part of the truce and open Sana'a Airport. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Dozens of people gathered in the Lebanese capital, Beirut, to mark Palestinian Prisoners' Day, a day when resistance factions and their supporters stand in solidarity with Palestinian prisoners held in Israeli jails.
On this day, which marks the Day of Palestinian Prisoners, I am certain that the people of the Arab and Muslim worlds, as we see in this gathering, will show the true unity with the resistance and the path of the resistance, especially with the issue of the prisoners and Al-Quds, which are the emblem of the Palestinian struggle.
Hezbollah Deputy Secretary General Sheikh Naim Qasem stressed that one cannot be truly with Palestine if they are not with the resistance.
It has become clear that whoever is with Palestine should be with the resistance. Anyone who has declared that he is with Palestine but hasn't taken one practical step in supporting the resistance is not truly with Palestine. Military resistance comes first. The other forms of resistance back and help to serve the actual resistance with arms.
He recalled that after the victory of the Islamic Revolution in Iran, late Imam Khomeini took the decision to close the Israeli embassy and reinstate the Palestinian embassy before declaring he was with Palestine. Liberating Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails has become a struggle for all resistance factions as it is linked directly to the Palestinian cause. They stress that liberating prisoners can only be realized completely by liberating Palestine. Officials of Palestinian resistance groups Hamas and Islamic Jihad considered that history has proven that only armed struggle can be a path to liberating both Al-Quds and the prisoners who continue to suffer
from Israel's aggressive policies. More than 4,400 Palestinian prisoners are currently held in Israeli jails. Minors and women are among 500 detainees under the so-called administrative detention policy, under which they are held without charge or trial for an indefinite time period. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Italians have slammed Israel's continued pursuit of repressive, violent practices against Palestinians following the killing of several Muslims, including a teenage boy, by Israeli security forces at the Al-Aqsa Mosque, a major holy site in Al-Quds, last week. Tensions between Israelis and Palestinians have been running high over the past weeks, with Israeli forces carrying out numerous raids in the West Bank, which led to the deaths of a number of Palestinians. The latest round of violence by Israel on Monday saw its soldiers forcing their way into the Al-Aqsa Mosque and removing worshippers from its courtyards in order to allow settlers to exclusively mark the Passover holiday into the compound.
Once again, during Ramadan, a new aggression against Palestinians by the Israeli regime. This time they caught off guard men, women and children who were praying at the Al-Aqsa Mosque. This again has shown the nature of the Israeli regime and the complacence of the international community.
Last year, during Ramadan, similar violence broke out, sparking the biggest conflict in years between Palestinian resistance movements and Israel, an 11-day war which only ended following intervention by international mediators. The violence against Palestinians at the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in the occupied old city of Al-Quds came at a particularly sensitive time. Ramadan this year coincided with the Christian Holy Week, which ends today, Monday, the second day of Eastertide. Catholic faithful have strongly condemned the latest killing of Palestinians by Israeli security forces.
For the umpteenth time, it is a provocation by Israel. This action were just a fresh provocation. There is a lack of respect for others' beliefs. During Easter time and Ramadan, we have to be more thoughtful.
Tensions there are due exclusively to Israeli occupation policy. However, the international community seems to have lost interest in the conflict. By not taking any side, the Italian government is supporting Israel in practical terms.
Last meeting between Italian and Palestinian authorities took place in December when Palestinian Foreign Minister Riyad al-Maliki met his Italian counterpart Luigi Di Maio on the sidelines of the 7th edition of the Rome Med Dialogues Conference. Other than reiterating Italy's traditional support for the Palestinian Authority, Di Maio reaffirmed Italy's commitment to a just, sustainable and negotiated two-state solution between Palestine and Israel as the key to stability and prosperity in the enlarged Mediterranean. Max Civili, Rome.
People in the port city of Karachi hit the streets to voice their outrage at the ouster of the elected government. The protesters say the U.S. conspired against their country. While Imran Khan never sought sore ties with any nation during his short-lived premiership.
Former Prime Minister Imran Khan has accused Biden administration in Washington for toppling his government in Pakistan, for not towing U.S.'s line on foreign policy.
Khan said that his life is in danger, but he prioritizes Pakistan's independence over his life.
Imran Khan had twice tweeted, or in fact more, but he had a clear clear message for the U.S. administration that we are partners in peace. We will always be partners in peace. We are partners in trade. We'll always be partners in trade with the whole world, with everybody. But we will not take dictation from anybody.
I'm here specifically to do my part in wanting and executing the Pakistan that we all want. And I think Imran Khan represents a vision of that Pakistan. And I personally, honestly think it's not his job alone to do this. It's our job, our responsibility to come out and do this for ourselves. That's why I'm here.
We've gathered here because of the sovereignty of Pakistan, and we want Pakistan to get justice and Imran Khan to get justice and we don't believe in the fake government.
Khan says U.S. diplomats started meeting some Pakistani officials 4 months ago, adding that Pakistan's ambassador to the U.S. was threatened.
We've gathered here to fight for a more democratic Pakistan, to fight for a free and independent Pakistan, to fight for a Pakistan that doesn't get bullied. That is our main reason for being here, for standing up for Pakistan, its sovereignty.